You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of June 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn and Marcus Hippie.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's agenda. Adam Huck from Foreign Policy Center joins us with the three stories we need to know. Adam, what do you have for us today?
Going to be talking about the EU summit, getting jobs back into the European economies, looking forward to Croatian accession, and also the impact of the Mongolian elections and what that means for international investment.
Also, Israel is hoping to join the likes of CNN and Al Jazeera by launching its own 24-hour news network. Question is, who's going to be watching?
And we also look on who are the immigrant Brazilians in a new book by American anthropologist Maxine Margolis and what it was that drove them out of the country.
Principally hyperinflation of, you know, something like 1,200% inflation a year. And in many cases, people who were quite educated could not find jobs in the areas in which they were trained.
Plus, if you see something, say something. Does that phrase build mistrust or can it be a positive message as well? We're in New York City to find out.
It establishes a feeling of community and gives some sense of security, knowing that others are watching their back.
We'll also find out what's making the headlines in Spain. We'll review this morning's Turkish front pages, and we play some music as well. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So, lots to come in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the latest world news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has called off a trip to Mozambique as his predecessor Nelson Mandela remains critically ill in hospital in Pretoria. Mr. Zuma called off his trip to Thursday's regional summit in Maputo after visiting the 94-year-old former leader late on Wednesday. The presidential spokesman Mac Maharaj says Mandela's condition has deteriorated over the past 48 hours. Mandela has already spent 20 days in the hospital. It's his fourth hospital stay in 6 months. Ecuador's foreign minister says it could take several weeks to decide on the asylum application made by the secret surveillance whistleblower Edward Snowden. Snowden remains in the transit area at Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport after arriving from Hong Kong last weekend. Speaking through an interpreter, Ricardo Patino said the asylum application would be considered responsibly and human rights obligations would be weighed up.
Cuando nosotros tomamos una decisión, cuando tomemos una decisión, consideraremos todos esos riesgos.
When we make a decision, we will consider all these risks.
No se olviden que en la ocasión anterior, en el caso del señor Assange, nos tomamos 2 meses en analizar la situación, de tal manera que no tenemos por qué esperar que la decisión se tome tan rápidamente.
It took us 2 months to make the decision on the case of Assange, so do not expect us to make the decision sooner this time.
Egypt's president has warned that continuing unrest is threatening to paralyze the country. In a televised speech to mark the end of his first year in office, Mohamed Morsi admitted that he'd made mistakes since becoming president, but he said that every revolution has its enemies. Ahead of the speech, there were violent clashes between pro- and anti-government factions in the northern city of Mansoura, in which 2 people were killed and 170 more injured. Troops have been deployed in cities across the country ahead of anti-Morsi protests planned for the weekend. The US Secretary of State John Kerry, who's on a Middle East tour, is appealing for calm. He says the protests must be allowed, but they should be peaceful.
Our hopes are that all parties, everybody, whether it's the demonstration that takes place on Friday or the demonstration that takes place on Sunday, we'll all engage in peaceful, free expression of their points of view, but not engage in violence.
Kevin Rudd has been sworn in as Australia's new Prime Minister the day after defeating Julia Gillard in a Labour Party leadership vote. Ms Gillard stepped down as PM as soon as the result was announced, saying she'd be leaving politics. Mr Rudd takes over with less than 3 months until elections, which polls are suggesting Labour will lose heavily. Addressing Parliament for the first time since being sworn in, Mr Rudd paid tribute to Ms Gillard.
I acknowledge her great work as a standard bearer for women in our country. Australia's first Deputy Prime Minister, Australia's first woman as Prime Minister. I would also like to acknowledge the work that the former Treasurer did with me to prevent this country from rolling into global economic recession and avoiding mass unemployment.
Texas has carried out its 500th execution since it brought back the death penalty in 1982. 52-year-old Kimberly McCarthy, who was convicted of murder in 1997, was killed by lethal injection late on Wednesday night. She's the first woman to be executed in the US for nearly 3 years. Since the Supreme Court decided to allow the reintroduction of capital punishment in 1976, 40% of all executions in the country have been carried out in Texas. The Australian Safety Transport Bureau says an engine explosion on a Qantas flight from Singapore to Sydney 4 years ago happened because Rolls-Royce failed to identify a defective component. 433 passengers and 26 crew were on board the Airbus A380 when one of the engines blew up over Indonesia's Batam Island. A large section of turbine disc crashed into a house, but there were no injuries to anyone either on the plane or on the ground. The pilots returned to Singapore and landed with limited controls, stopping just 150 metres before the end of the runway with four blown tyres, brakes heated to 900 degrees Celsius and fuel leaking to the ground. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney, and we'll have Barney and the news headlines here on Monocle 24 in about 24 minutes again. It is 6 minutes past the hour, that is 16:06 in Tokyo, 8:06 in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Adam Hugg from the Foreign Policy Centre here in London joins us now in the studio to set the day's agenda. Welcome to the show, Adam. Let's talk about Europe's lost generation, shall we?
Well, yes, it's, you know, seems not that long ago since February when European leaders were hailing sort of the grand announcement they managed to sign off the budget. And we find ourselves back here in early June when in fact that hasn't actually been completed. And obviously we're now focusing on the issues around how Europe can get youth unemployment back together. But let's not forget that the European Parliament hasn't actually fully signed off the deal agreed last February, and there's going to be some horse trading at this summit about how the budget deal can be made more flexible to help deal with issues like youth jobs. And you're seeing mass migration across Europe at the moment, particularly from the south towards Germany, and interestingly from the south to some of their former colonies, because the situation is so dire, particularly for the younger generation. And you know, Europe's leaders need to be sort of really getting this signed and sealed and beginning to deal with it.
Where do we see the biggest disagreements?
Well, I think it's about, in part, it's a power play between the institutions. Ultimately, this is one of the first times the Parliament has been flexing its co-decision muscles. So in a sense, it's about trying to make sure that, I mean, the Parliament was quite hurt that they'd sort of been forgotten in the discussions, whereas in fact they are supposed to be sort of co-decision making with the European Council, and I think so. There's an element at which, you know, national governments desire to cut the amount of EU budget compared to European parliamentarians focus on trying to get the priorities of where that money is spent. And I think you're trying to see some flexibility now around how they can switch spending from one area to another as when demand hits during the cycle. Whereas obviously, you know, national governments want to see stability, or they want to know what they're going to be paying and what it's going to go on, so they can go home and tell their domestic constituencies, whereas MEPs are trying to get some flexibility.
Because the figures are really quite startling, aren't they? In Spain, more than 50% of young people are unemployed. In Italy, that figure is about 45%. Across the EU, generally, about a quarter of young people under the age of 25 are unemployed. And there's a real sense, a new poll out this week showed that lots of young people have resigned to the fact that they think they may never get a job. This is a huge issue.
Well, it's a huge issue that obviously the EU as an institution can only go so far to address. They're talking about delivering a €6 billion youth jobs fund, ultimately spread across the whole EU, that's is a drop in the ocean. But it's attempted to be a political symbol to show that the making impact. But it's, you know, causing problems for domestic governments, and also and because they see austerity as being linked to the EU, actually sort of undermining long-term support for the EU as an institution.
Adam, nowadays we don't seem to get good news from the European Union front very often, but at least something is happening. Croatia is about to join the European Union on the 1st of July. How excited are, first of all, the Croatians, and how excited is the rest of the European Union?
Well, I think that's the point, that, you know, this is a story that is going under the radar to a certain extent, I think, but, you know, quite a lot of Europeans have got used to Croatia as being part of the European scene. It's one of the major tourist destinations, certainly for families here from the UK. And ultimately, it's a process that's been long in the build-up, and now it's sort of go, and you have and some of that excitement that there was first time around in Croatia has been lost, again, because the overall economic situation there is so dire. I think one of the positive things for sort of hard-pressed Croatian consumers is that the cost of imported food and other products from the EU is going to drop about 20% come July the 1st as the tariffs are removed. And that's some positivity. Obviously, they won't have access to full labour mobility for another couple of years. They've got a similar deal to the Romanians and Bulgarians. So, you know, the excitement that there was once hoped for isn't there, but it's still a step in the right direction. And ultimately, for Europe, having, you know, expanding to 28, no longer being 27, is, you know, a sign that the enlargement process, however stalled, is still slowly creaking its way forward. You know, ultimately, this as a symbol may help put energy back into discussions elsewhere in the Balkans, and, you never know, into the background of the Turkey discussion, showing that Europe is willing to open up, no matter how slowly.
And from the Balkans, let's move south to the Middle East. John Kerry is in the region, highlighting the fact that the Palestinians still do not have a prime minister.
Yes, we had a situation where president of Annaga University, the biggest university in Palestine, came in as a sort of technocratic head of government, about 18 days in post. He was someone who was seen, you know, although a political unknown, someone who'd got a lot of experience sort of working with both Fatah and Hamas people, experience of Gulf fundraising, which is obviously one of the key things you need in a current Palestinian prime minister. But ultimately, he felt that he was unable to do it because of the politics within the Palestinian Authority, and, you know, someone who he was feeling undermined by some of his deputies that President Abbas had chosen for him. And you see now, you need to get stability back into the governance of the Palestinian Authority, because they have a huge financial crisis, in the sense that they're over $4 billion in debt. And obviously that's, you know, in terms of some of the numbers we're talking about on the European scale, that doesn't sound that much. But obviously, given the size of the Palestinian Authority's budget, that is a significant problem. And, you know, donor funds have gone elsewhere. They've been hit since the since last year's UN vote. Problem, yeah, obviously, some of the Gulf funds that were previously have gone into there, going elsewhere to Syria, to Gaza, also, you know, so and obviously European budgets, as we just said, have been squeezed. So, in some donor funding from there is obviously, you know, not a resource that can be tapped again in the same way as they would previously have hoped. So, it's a big challenge for whoever comes into the job. But that getting stability there is absolutely essential if you want to get a resumption of negotiations around a new Palestinian government, a reconciliation deal with Hamas, but also giving the platform to negotiate effectively, because Kerry set a September deadline for progress, and there's not been any sign that that's likely to be happening on either side.
Adam, one more news topic from you. You'd like to mention something about the Mongolian elections.
Yes, I mean, a lot of people think Genghis Khan, and that's about it for Mongolia. But ultimately, it has been one of the fastest growing countries in the world for the last couple of years.
We should pay more attention.
Well, yeah, it's got a population of 2.8 million, and it's got projected mineral reserves of about 1.3 trillion.
And had startling growth last year. 12% is the number that the economy grew last year. So it just highlights how fast they're growing.
Well, exactly. But I think, I mean, while economists had previously been predicting about 18% growth this year, what's happened is that, in part because of the election, there's been some horse trading around sort of long-term deals that would help develop the Oyu Tolgoi mine in the South Gobi, which is one of the world's biggest copper mines. And that's, you know, ultimately the deal, long-term deals to help develop that, have been held up by this process. So the question is, can, now we've got the election out the way and President Albedorge has been, seems to be narrowly re-elected on the first ballot, so just over 50%, whether that gives him the impetus to go and get a deal that balances the long-term needs of international investors with the needs of the Mongolian people.
That was Adam Huck from the Foreign Policy Centre. Thank you very much for setting the day's agenda for us.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll be finding out what's behind Israel's move to launch a new 24-hour news channel. We'll be right back.
It's that time of year when Monocle's mighty July-August double issue hits the newsstands with a glorious and satisfying thud. It's the issue where we name the best cities to call home, be the people who know how to run a good metropolis, check out the businesses that care about more than profits, and also find a few dustier, grittier places that you should know. Here's what our editors have lined up for you to enjoy on your lounger.
In the design section, we go street cleaning with the wonderful Greenbird team in Tokyo. We knock on the doors of the people who live in the pioneering Harlan estate outside Bern, and we strip off for a steamy fashion story in Helsinki's newest, cutest public sauna.
In the edit section, we take you for a stroll around some of the world's best public parks, including Singapore Gardens by the Bay, Margaret Island in Budapest, and São Paulo's Ibirapuera Park, three places where you can work out surrounded by nature, sculptures, and open-air cinema.
The July-August issue of Monocle also includes our inaugural 68-page food and entertaining guide and a 24-page Rio de Janeiro survey. It will keep you content with content all summer long. It's on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
Following similar initiatives in cities around the world, from Paris to Jakarta, Monocle are partnering with the interior design retail space Sansiri Lounge in Bangkok to offer a range of Monocle products, including accessories, homewares, stationery and fashion, and collaborations with some of our favourite designers. So, whether you're treating a loved one or just spoiling yourself, come to the Monocle Shop and Shop in Bangkok. You can find us on the third floor of the Siam Paragon Shopping Centre from the 26th of June to the 1st of July.
Now, flick through satellite TV and you'll see just how crowded the English news market is. You've got CNN, Al Jazeera, BBC, France 24, CCTV. The list goes on and on. And with more networks clamoring for tighter advertising and sponsorship dollars, it is an increasingly tough arena for any news organization to join. But despite these tough conditions, one country is ready to leap into the market with a new 24-hour news channel, Israel.
Launching on the 1st of July, i24 will be live 24 hours a day and will be broadcast in English, Arabic and French. More than 150 journalists and editors have already been hired, and a brand new studio in the Jaffa Port awaits its first live transmission. So what is behind the launch of i24, and are concerns that the channel could be an instrument for propaganda true? Joining us now on the line is Ofer Peretzman-Shema, head of English channel i24 News. Welcome to the show, Ofer. First of all, Phil already mentioned that there is quite a lot of competition already when it comes to international news channels. What exactly is the market gap you are going to be filling?
Yes, the market is quite full, but there aren't any international news channels coming from the Middle East. This is the first one. And we hope doing good work, good journalism. It's still a lot of stories and a lot of news to cover.
Well, you have Al Jazeera, which is obviously based in Qatar, one of the leading international news organizations in the region. As Marcus mentioned, you apparently have hired 150 journalists and editors. Give us a sense of where those journalists and editors have come from. Have they been hired from within Israel, or are we really getting an international group of employees?
Well, I'm looking right now at my newsroom, and there are journalists coming from France, from the United States, from England, from Portugal, Israel, of course, and it's like multicultural, multilingual. It's not just Israelis and Israelis and Israelis. Some of them worked for CBS, BBC, ABC News, France 24, BFM TV in France, and a lot of stations.
Alfa, what is your answer or reply to concerns that have been expressed that, you know, this channel could be an instrument for propaganda?
This is the thing, because it's a private organization and it's a private channel. We have no, and it's sitting in the Jaffa port, and if you could look from the window from one of our studio right now and see the Mediterranean Sea, the thing is it's private and the headquarters are sitting in Europe. So we international, we have no political reflection, no governmental, no restriction on the Israeli media, like stations in Israel have to deal with. We are fully private.
But although the channel will be 100% private and based within Europe, private individuals can still obviously carry their own political agenda. So how do you address concerns that there will be no agenda of any sort? Is there going to be a transparency? How transparent will the company be? Will there be, the ability to, you know, criticize perhaps the channel if people do have concerns that it's going in a certain direction?
This is a television, so it's fully transparent. You see the shows on television, and you see you will see the shows on the live stream via the website. So we're not doing it behind curtains. It's open to the public. People will see the shows, see the content, see the coverage, and remark. I know that the first reflection is, you're doing a propaganda, you're doing an Israeli channel. It's totally, and me as head of the English channel, that we have three heads, of French and Arabic as well, and we're sitting and deliberating, and we've decided some guidelines, but it's fully transparent. It's news on television. How more transparent can it be?
Ulfa, you just said that, which I quite agree with, that on the 1st of July when you actually go on there, we'll see what it's going to be like, and that's how you're going to prove what it's going to be like. What can you tell us about the programs? What exactly are we going to see on television on the 1st of July?
Well, you're going to see news, of course, news editions and news bulletins every 30 minutes. We have three daily shows of sports, economy, culture and internet and the web program. We have a morning show at 8 o'clock in the morning and the evening big edition at 8 o'clock at night. And because the studios and the newsroom and the teams are working all the time, whenever news breaks, we can get into the studio and broadcast out. Cut our regular programming and then do the breaking news.
Ofer Peretz-Mensheimer, head of the English channel I24 News. Many thanks for joining us here on the program, and all the best of luck with the big launch on July 31st.
It is 16:23 in Tokyo, 8:23 in London. Brazil used to be known as a land of immigrants, but since the late 80s, they have moved to become an immigrant nation instead. American anthropologist Maxine Margolis, a Brazil enthusiast, just released a new book analyzing who are those Brazilian that escaped from the land of soccer and samba.
Well, our emigrant Brazilian researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to her and also got her comments about the recent protests that are happening in Brazil at the moment.
They began leaving Brazil in the late 1980s, early 1990s, going first to the United States and then to several countries in Europe, Portugal, Spain, Italy, also to Great Britain and Ireland, and Japan. Lots of Brazilians of Japanese ancestry went legally to Japan to work. And for the most part, the reasons they left home were economic. During the late 1980s and early 1990s, Brazil suffered from a number of economic crises, principally hyperinflation of, you know, something like 1,200% inflation a year. Also low salaries and fairly high cost of living, especially in the big cities of Brazil. And in many cases, people who were quite educated, who had university degrees, could not find jobs in the areas in which they were trained that paid middle class salaries. And so they began seeking their fortune, so to speak, elsewhere. I will say, however, that I would say probably 95% of Brazilians who left Brazil left with the idea that their departure was temporary and that they planned to return after they saved a requisite amount of money. So they were not true immigrants in the sense they, most of them at least, did not plan to stay abroad permanently.
And maybe that's one of the reasons which you mention in the book as well, that Brazilian communities abroad, they're not very well organized, like the Koreans, for example. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. There are relatively few Brazilian-based associations, organizations. I could count the number of them in the U.S. on, you know, the fingers of one hand. But people who want to make as much money as fast as possible and then return home don't want to spend time and efforts in organizing or organizations or associations. Moreover, their feeling is, why should they? They're only here temporarily. Why put the time and effort into such a thing? So you do see, I would call it an underdevelopment of Brazilian immigrant-based institutions in the U.S. and elsewhere, in contrast to those of some other immigrant groups.
And do they usually come from the same social background? Or the Brazilian community worldwide is kind of more diverse?
Initially, until about the year 2000, the Brazilian emigres were overwhelmingly middle class and lower middle class, and many of them were from large Brazilian cities. And they came, for example, to the U.S. on tourist visas, and then they overstayed their visas and took jobs. Since about 2000, Brazilians of more modest backgrounds, both in terms of social class and education, have been arriving, particularly in the United States. They are more likely to be from small towns in Brazil than from big cities. And they are much more likely to have arrived in the U.S. via the border with Mexico. Why? Because they wouldn't qualify for tourist visas, and so they take the much more expensive and dangerous route of flying to Mexico City, making their way overland, and then crossing over the international frontier into the U.S.
Recently, there's a lot of Brazilians actually returning to the country. Do you see kind of a reverse trend at the moment?
You do. The only thing we don't know is how significant it is. That is, what is the size? We pretty much know the causes, and this is what I talk about in the last chapter in the book. Social scientists talk about push-pull, you know, what factors push people out of some place and pull them into another country. And in the case of Brazilians in the U.S., as well as those in Western Europe, the Great Recession beginning in 2008, which led to higher levels of unemployment, was the push factor that sent many Brazilians fleeing home. You know, why they basically said, why should we live as undocumented immigrants in foreign lands if we're not fully employed and making decent wages? At the same time, until 2010, the Brazilian economy was booming. It was growing until 2010, I think, at 7.5% a year. Since then, it has slowed down considerably. But nevertheless, between 2008 and the present, number of Brazilians, probably a large number, returned home. The only thing is that we really don't know how many actually did so.
What's your view on the recent protest in the country? Do you think that might influence something in terms
of... Yeah, I'm fascinated by them. A lot of the complaints about Brazilian society I have heard about since I first went to Brazil many years ago, the poor state of public education and healthcare and corruption and impunity and all that. I've heard this for years, so the complaints are not new. What is amazing is that people have taken to the streets in a big way, and they just, you know, Brazil is becoming a first world country. It's the sixth largest economy in the world, and yet the public transportation is horrible. People spend hours a day commuting to their jobs in very uncomfortable conditions, and I think it just, you know, it was enough is enough.
And Maxine, just as a final question, where did it came this interest for Brazil?
Well, when I was a graduate student, I went to Columbia University as a graduate student, and there was the opportunity to go one summer to either Brazil or to Colombia. And I saw the movie Black Orpheus, and I decided I wanted to go to Brazil, and I went. I spoke not a word of Portuguese at the time, and I spent one summer in outside the city of Salvador in northeastern Brazil. And as we say in Portuguese, eu me apaixonei. I became passionate about Brazil and have been a Brazilianist ever since.
Well, muito obrigado pela entrevista, Maxine.
De nada, de nada.
It's a fascinating book, and thank you very much for joining us.
Well, you're very welcome. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Pleasure. Tchau, tchau, Maxine.
Tchau, tchau.
Muito obrigado.
That was American anthropologist Maxine Margolis with our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who is very passionate about Brazil as well, I can
tell
you.
Just a little bit.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll be finding out what's making the headlines in Spain. We'll review this morning's front pages and we'll talk trust in our cities. But first, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has called off a trip to Mozambique as his predecessor Nelson Mandela remains critically ill in hospital in Pretoria. The presidential spokesman, Mac Maharaj, says Mandela's condition has deteriorated over the past 48 hours. Ecuador's foreign minister says it could take several weeks to decide on the asylum application made by the secret surveillance whistleblower Edward Snowden. Snowden remains in the transit area at Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport after arriving from Hong Kong last weekend. Egypt's president has warned that continuing unrest is threatening to paralyze the country. In a televised speech to mark the end of his first year in office, Mohamed Morsi admitted he'd made mistakes since becoming president, but he said every revolution has its enemies. Kevin Rudd's been sworn in as Australia's new Prime Minister the day after defeating Julia Gillard in a Labour Party leadership vote. Ms Gillard stepped down as PM as soon as the result was announced, saying she'd be leaving politics. Texas has carried out its 500th execution since it brought back the death penalty in 1982. 52-year-old Kimberly McCarthy, who was convicted of murder in 1997, is the first woman to be executed in the US for nearly 3 years. The Australian Safety Transport Bureau says an engine explosion on a Qantas flight from Singapore to Sydney 4 years ago happened because Rolls-Royce failed to identify a defective component. 433 passengers and 26 crew were on board the Airbus A380 when one of the engines blew up over Indonesia's Batam Island. The pilots managed to return to Singapore and landed with limited controls. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi, and Phil Hahn. In this week's episode of The Urbanist, we'll find out who we trust in cities and why, from crime to construction, advertising to tourism.
But in this preview, we're heading to New York City, where shortly after the events of September 11th, 2001, one phrase became commonplace. If you see something, say something. Now it's used by more than 150 organizations, agencies, and universities across the world. And though some might see the campaign as fuel for more distrust and paranoia, its creator, Alan Kay, sees it as a unifying message. Pauline Eiferman met the CEO of the advertising firm Corey Kay and Partners in his office on Fifth Avenue.
The formal name, full name, is If You See Something, Say Something. And it is the only global anti-terrorist campaign on the planet or any other.
And can you walk me through the steps of creating this campaign?
It was after 9/11. I was quite upset, as most people were. And when I'm upset and I want to do something, I do advertising because that's all I really know how to do very well. And I felt that while people were saying this is a crisis, I thought it was a chronic. I felt it was a situation that was not going to go away. And I felt that Americans were not prepared for it, that we had never really faced anything of this scale before. And unlike countries like Israel, who have learned to live with it, we would have to learn to live with it, as unfortunate as that is. And then my brain went into autopilot and thought, well, what would I like to do? And I felt that the best thing to do would be an ounce of prevention, that if we could sensitize people that things could happen and make them aware of their surroundings to keep future disasters from happening, if we could just prevent one, that would be worth it. and out came "If you see something, say something," which I felt was the simplest way to tell people what to do and remind them to be vigilant for their sake and the sake of others.
And so you created this phrase, and what happened after that?
After that, the MTA, who's our long-term client, came to us and said they too had been thinking about doing a security campaign. And I had told them previously about "If you see something, say something." And they said, you know, that would be great. What if we use that? And them being a good client, I said, certainly, I would love to see it out there in the public. They thought it was fabulous. They said it gives them a very good feeling to know that everyone is looking out for everyone else. And it's like New York has now 16 million eyes watching out for each other. And as soon as they heard that, the printing presses rolled.
I'm interested in the process of you sitting down after 9/11 and thinking about what you can do. How did you approach the challenge of doing something that's effective but not making people paranoid or distrusting?
The objective was to try to help prevent future disasters. I thought about a very famous phrase from World War II, which was "loose lips sink ships." And it struck me as ironic because what I really wanted to do was just the opposite. Instead of having people be quiet, that if they did see something that looked suspicious or dangerous, to let someone know about it and not just ignore it and, God forbid, something terrible happen.
And do you think it's a campaign that makes people trust each other more or less?
I would say definitely more, because it establishes a feeling of community and gives some sense of security, knowing that others are watching their back.
Last year, 1,944 New Yorkers saw something and said something. Thank you for keeping your eyes and ears open.
Well, now it's being used in over 150 locations around the world, picked up by people I never met. They're allowed to use it for free.
Do you think before 9/11 and after 9/11, in general, do you think that New Yorkers are quite trusting people, or would you see them as more complacent, and how do you think your campaign fit in that?
I think there's a difference between trusting in general and being complacent when it comes to being aware of your surroundings. I think New Yorkers are definitely good-hearted. I think that they're trusting in nature. I think before 9/11, they were jaded, and if you grew up in Manhattan, you were taught kind of to walk with your eyes down, don't make eye contact. If there's trouble, walk away from it. But in this case, because this really was a world-changing event, they had opened their eyes. And it's not that we're saying snoop on people or anything. It's nothing like that. It's like if somebody's going rock climbing, you say to them, you know, beware of snakes. That doesn't mean that they look under every rock for a snake. It just means that they be alert to the fact that there might be snakes there, and if they see one, to watch out for it. It's really as simple as that in my mind.
What would you say to people who would say that this makes people scared or paranoid?
I'd say that's ridiculous. First of all, they should be alert. We're not saying to get nuts over anything. We're just saying if something is suspicious, be aware of it. That's all. It's just common sense. And one could say, well, if you didn't say that, they'd know it. Well, that's not true. Look at London. Look at Spain. Look at Mumbai. People saw things and they said nothing.
I saw that now the Department of Homeland Security is using it. Did you ever imagine that it was going to grow so much? And does that make you happy?
Frankly, I thought it would, because I thought it was right and I thought it was necessary. It makes me very happy because I do know that it has done a lot of good. If you just simply take the case of the bomb that was found in the van in Times Square, the person who saw it, when he was interviewed, they say, what would you tell New Yorkers? He said, I would tell them, if you see something, say something.
And that was advertising creative Alan Kay speaking to our correspondent in New York, Pauline Eiferman. And of course, you can catch The Urbanist tonight at 2100 hours in Istanbul, 1900 hours here in London, and 1400 hours if you're in Toronto.
You are listening to Midori House. In a moment, we'll be heading to Spain to find out why Madrid is getting a new airport.
The results are out. Monocle's 7th annual Quality of Life survey has shuffled the deck and ranks the cities we think are most livable in 2013. And the winner is Copenhagen.
This is a population and a city that's become markedly more extrovert in recent years. There's more life on the streets than ever before, and its people are not only more engaged locally, but also eager to show Copenhagen off to the rest of the world. Copenhageners have hit a high point of pride in their city, and it shows.
Copenhagen, our film about the best city to call home. On Monocle.com.
What can you do in a Moscow traffic jam? Are rich cities boring cities? How do you create a quake-proof capital? Which city has drag stars as taxi drivers? Who lives in the skyscraper squat? How do you build a city from scratch? And who ditched the garbage truck for a pony and cart? Get the answers to the city's biggest questions and challenges every week on The Urbanist, our show about the cities we live in. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, it premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Marco Sipian Filhan. The time is 9:42 in Madrid. It's 8:42 here in London, but it is indeed Spain where we are heading next.
Joining us now on the line from the Spanish capital is our correspondent there, Liam Aldis. Liam, thanks for joining us on the program this morning. I hear there's a famous football player who may be in a bit of trouble over there in Spain.
Yes, it's tax time of the year, and it seems that Lionel Messi, the world's most famous football player, actually hasn't been paying his tax for the last 6 years. Apparently, he's been accused of not paying up to 4.5 million euros in tax between the years 2007 and 2009, and this has caused a huge scandal, tipping off his football throne, if you will. But he's actually got kind of preempted the tax man and paid them an extra 10 million euros just because apparently he wasn't paying his tax between 2010 and 2012 either. So it's interesting to hear that he just has 10 million euros stashed away in the bank accounts to just casually pay the tax man.
Just out of curiosity, has Messi come up with any kind of explanation why he hasn't paid his taxes?
Apparently, there's been talk that his father was in charge of his finances, and there was a bit of fiddling with his. Apparently, he ceded his advertising rights, and apparently, it was kind of funneled through some tax haven countries or something along the lines. It's all a little tricky, but the fact that he has paid up front immediately seems to show that he was guilty, and he's trying to avoid the 4-year jail term and perhaps a fine of 28 million euros. So we'll see if he actually does get a punishment. We'll see if he gets any special treatment just because he's a footballer.
And Messi isn't the only famous Spaniard to have gotten into a bit of trouble over tax. There's another famous individual.
Yes, Sergi Arola, one of the Spain's most famous chefs, has actually had his restaurant in Madrid, the gastro restaurant, shut down last Tuesday because he owes $300,000 in outstanding tax. And he's been quite angry by the closure, saying that he actually offered the tax man a payment plan. There was apparently a mix-up. Apparently, they didn't understand what they had to pay. Well, who knows whether that was true or not, but the tax man refused and shut down the restaurant and they're refusing to let them open it until they pay. But he's come out swinging, saying that football clubs, for example, owe a lot of tax and they don't have the football stadiums closed down, so why is his restaurant being closed down? So his wife actually runs the restaurant and she was in tears, and apparently the tax people came in while people were dining in the restaurant and ordered everyone out, so it was a bit dramatic.
Liam, do these two high-profile cases actually reveal that the Spanish tax agency is actually working harder than before?
Yeah, it seems seems that there is perhaps a task force behind the scenes really targeting some high-profile people to perhaps scare people into paying their taxes and also recuperate a lot of money that they're not getting. So there has been some very famous ad campaigns over the years to make sure Spaniards pay their taxes, and perhaps instead of a massive advertising campaign, they're just going after celebrities and generating a lot of news. It seems perhaps it's working.
And another story which has grabbed your attention, Liam, the government releasing its administration reform package, not necessarily the sexiest name, but what can you tell us about it?
Yeah, it's not a very good name, is it? But it actually aims to cut about 37.7 billion euros over the next 3 years out of the public budget, basically by eliminating and merging about 57 public bodies and organizations. It sounds it's quite technical and sounds a little boring, but I'm actually quite excited about it because Spain is quite famous for, they've got this expression called passing the ball, which is pasando la pelota, which basically if you go to a public administration, they will send you to another public administration. You have a query and they'll just send you to another department and you just get passed around and nothing ever gets resolved. So perhaps this reform will kind of stop that tendency a little, and I'm hoping it will anyway.
Liam, you are very excited about this, but what about the Spanish people in the country?
Well, there's a big fear that it might lead to a lot more job cuts. But in the announcement of the policy, the finance minister and the vice president said that it actually aims to not eliminate any jobs. It's just to eliminate spending. So they've actually cut, since 2011, they've actually cut 370,000 public sector jobs, which is huge over the last 2 years, which has contributed greatly to the unemployment rate. But the Spanish people are taking it with a pinch of salt. But some of the regional premiers are calling it a power grab by Madrid, saying that they're just trying to consolidate power in Madrid. And this is kind of illustrated by the fact that Madrid is calling for the elimination of some public ombudsmen in the regions, as well as some local audit courts and a few local bodies that would consolidate power in Madrid. So if you understand Spanish politics, you know that there's a lot of hustle and tussle between the regions. This could cause a bit of a fight.
And of course, this is just one in a long line of cuts that Rajoy has made over the past. Is there a sense there that Spaniards perhaps are a bit more accustomed to austerity, tough austerity, than perhaps their cousins in Italy, for example?
I don't think they're accustomed to it. I mean, if you look at the streets and you see how many protests there are, I mean, especially in Madrid, every week there's protests and people aren't happy, especially when it comes to health and education, the kind of the sacred policy areas in Spain, and people just aren't used to it. So I really do think when we have elections in another couple of years, Rajoy's government will be punished. But I think there is a move now to, instead of just focusing on cuts, they are trying to maybe paint the cuts in a different way and in reform packages like this one. So I guess time will tell.
Liam, it's been announced that Madrid is to get another airport. What do you need it for?
Yeah, I was quite surprised. Everyone was taken by surprise by this new airport. But apparently all the private jets that are landing in Madrid are getting quite impatient because they're having to wait for their landing because they're not prioritized before passenger airliners. So the regional government has announced they're going to build an airport just for private jets. And he said that we really need this, especially for business people. And then when he announced that where it was going to be, just 10 minutes from the Eurovegas macro casino project, people realized that perhaps it had something to do with the deal that was struck between the government and Sheldon Adelson, the casino magnate. So a lot of questions are being raised about whether this was just to please the casino magnate. It's going to cost 220 million euros. So it's a huge project. We'll see if a lot more jets are landing in Madrid after it's built.
Let's hope so. That was Monocle's man in Madrid, Liam. Thank you very much for joining us on the program.
In just a moment, we're going to be reviewing this morning's Turkish front pages with Monocle's Alexandra de Kramer in just a moment. But to take us there, here's one of her favorite songs. It's a remix of Gökhan Keser's song Bazin featuring Sila. Kendime bazen de çoğalıyor bazen bazenler çoğalıyor bazenler çoğalıyor bazen. What a beautiful voice they had. Didn't
I really liked that track.
That was Gökhan Geser with Bazin featuring Sila.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Marco Sippi, and Phil Han, who is learning Turkish every day.
Oh, good,
It's time for us now to go through this morning's Turkish front pages. And joining us now in the studio is Monocle's Alex de Kramer. Good morning, Alex. Your first story is about Egemen Baş, who is the chief European Union negotiator in Turkey, and he's actually been inviting some people for a lunch.
Yeah, Egemen Baş held a luncheon in the EU Affairs Ministry for EU ambassadors of EU states to, because after the Germany delayed the EU negotiations for 4 months, he wanted to prove that Gezi Park protests weren't as violent as they were shown, so he handed out everyone booklets saying that the Turkish government was actually acting like some EU members and giving protesters the appropriate rights, but obviously
because Turkey has been trying for a long time, these negotiations have been a long time going.
Three decades
trying to get into the European Union.
Yeah.
And a lot of people thought maybe finally the time was right that this was actually going to happen. Negotiations were going quite well, and then the conflict, it's all kicked off in Taksim Square and has really sidelined those negotiations, haven't they?
True. I don't know if we can say that it was actually going well. It was going a step further for sure, and the EU was acting much more pro-Turkey. But I think this is also another reason that Turkey shouldn't be in the EU. I think it's a part that Gezi Park is actually a healthy shows that Turkey is a healthy democracy. I agree that the police have violently attacked peaceful protesters. But I think it should be something that the EU supports in terms of people and human rights.
Alex, can I just ask, I need to know, what was in the booklets? Basically, Mr. Baş was trying to prove that Turkish officials or the police did nothing wrong.
Yeah. So there were pictures and of demonstrators just on the streets and the police standing apparently next to them.
But haven't we already seen pictures where police is actually using violence?
Yeah, they are. And Thomas, big tanks spraying people with water.
Well, maybe he thought that they just didn't watch the news and they had no idea what's going on.
Because Turkish TV, as you know, had showed like penguins, a documentary on penguins when this all was happening. So maybe he thought other news organizations were following that lead.
Talking about those demonstrations and all, 200 protesters have been arrested for their standing man demonstrations.
So actually, this is really interesting. So after people, the standing man is like one of the latest demonstrations happening, protests, peaceful protests happening in Gezi Park, which started with an actor just standing there for 6 hours by himself in Gezi Park. And then people kept on joining. And it just grew immensely. So people go there and stand for 2 hours, 6 hours. Other people come, bring them water, food, put them next to them because they're just like moving, check their pulse. My friend actually was telling me she did for 2 hours and her limbs were hurting because she was reading a book as well. So people as a statement, they're reading George Orwell and Aldous Huxley to make statements. So yeah, Egemen Baş actually said after midnight, anyone that stands as standing in the square is going to be considered a member of a terrorist organization, and they just took everyone that was standing there.
So that is the way to give police officers a reason to actually arrest people.
Yeah.
But it really is government property. It's quite startling that this is still, you know, they haven't really relaxed their stance on these protesters in any way, shape, or form. And there's, you know, such a peaceful way of protesting. What's been the reaction in Turkey, in the press?
The press has been really silent. That's the main problem as well. Everyone, the way people are, no one's reading newspapers. The way people are communicating with each other is Facebook and Twitter and these social microblogging sites. Bianet, which is an online website, has grown a lot because they actually feature what people are saying. But obviously, this is the reason Gezi Park became what it is because of the way police acted towards peaceful protesters, and they haven't stepped down a bit. It's exactly the same way, which is really, as you said, really startling.
And another story from the Cumhuriyet newspaper as well. This is the Kurdish bid for more negotiations, a bit of a wise person's summit.
So we mentioned this in the beginning, and obviously because of what has been happening, this has been second plan. Prime Minister Erdogan launched this project to include the Kurdish citizens in the Turkish government. And as the PKK has started to leave, actually 15% has left the Turkish borders. And this People of Wise Council, their 63 members, have been divided into seven regions of the country and traveled to 81 provinces, 37 towns to talk to meet, it says, more than 60,000 people. They have, and they were just interviewing people how they,
to hear their thoughts, and that gives foundation for a process. Thank you very much. That was Alex de Kramer, Monocle's researcher. That's all we have time for today on the show. Thanks to our producer, Daniel Chocopelli, our researchers, Ferrand August Pacheco and Anton Fredriksson, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is The Culture Show with Robert Bound.
And I'll be back with Clemency Burton-Hill from Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn, it's saying goodbye.
Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.